Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Andy Gladding and Stephen Pardo are with us. I just met them last Saturday at Hofstra University, Stephen for the first time, and we're going to learn about mixing. I mean, as a broadcast engineer, I haven't done much audio mixing, live or recording, but I'm really interested in it. And Chris Tarr has some things to add, too, from his mixing experience. It's coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, worry-free transmission you can count on with outstanding control, reliability, efficiencies, and Nautel's unmatched 24/7 customer support, online at nautel.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm in the Nashville studios of This Week in Radio Tech and sponsored here by, can you guess, Telos Alliance. Thanks a lot, Telos Alliance, for giving me an hour, hour and a half off on Thursday afternoons to do this show. Try to help out the industry, try to help out young and old and engineers of all ages and sizes with their jobs. Keep you entertained a little bit. And we're going to learn something as we move along together. So in Nashville, it's been just a beautiful, beautiful day. Yes, the weather report from Nashville. What is it? It's 80 degrees and just a gorgeous day. But Chris Tarr has a weather update from Mukwonago. Chris, good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Suncast, you can bring that up. This is the weather at Casa de Tarr at the moment. 63, and we had 3/10 of an inch of rain today, so it's been kind of just dreary. It's no good. So anyway, other than that, it's good to be here. Been a busy week, got a lot of little projects going on, so it's always nice to be able to take a few minutes out and hang out with you guys.
Chris, last Saturday, I had a wonderful experience. We got to go to Hofstra University, and I had never been there before. You know how the only way I'd ever heard of Hofstra University before I'd actually been there was from the once beloved Bill Cosby, because he made jokes that had Hofstra University in the joke. And that's sure how I learned about it. I didn't know if it was a real place or not. And then as an adult found out, oh yeah, that is a real place, and got invited to go. A few years ago, we met Andy Gladding. He's been on the show a couple of times now. And Andy is one of our guests right now. So Andy, welcome in. Hey, tell our audience, well, first of all, hello, how you doing? Good to see you, Andy.
Oh, I'm good, Kirk. You know, it's amazing how transmission works, because I could have sworn I saw you sitting in the office next to where I am right now at Hofstra about 2 days ago. So this is pretty wild. Now you're back in Tennessee.
It was great to spend some time with you guys, and tell the audience what we were all doing at Hofstra last weekend.
Well, we were really lucky at Hofstra. We WRHU, which is Hofstra University's radio station, celebrating more than 60 years being on the air on 88.7 FM. Recently worked out a relationship with the Society of Broadcast Engineers Chapter 15, and that has made Chapter 15 the largest Society of Broadcast Engineering chapter in the country, which is really cool, because it gives the professional members who are part of the SB 15 the chance to interface with college students who make up the next generation of broadcast engineers coming in. So to celebrate this relationship, which has been going quite strong for the last 2 years or so, we had the first ever SBE Chapter 15 Ennis Conference at Hofstra, which, if anybody here is familiar with the Society of Broadcast Engineers Ennis Conference, is a full day of broadcast engineering exercises. Traditionally, they're workshops, panels, lectures, and demonstrations of new equipment. But this year, we made things a little spicier. We tried to add to the traditional Ennis lineup and have things that would be geared down to some of the younger SBE members and student attendees, including, kind of a meet and greet with radio executives, a lecture from Frank Foti, the president of the Telos Alliance, who did a pretty killer presentation on audio processing and the radio station Z100, and most importantly, a live mix workshop featuring a local band, which I thought was so much fun, because, broadcast engineers and studio mix engineers, even though we both work in audio, there's always a little bit of a gap and even like a competition between what it is and who does what. So it was really fun to see those two worlds put together. So yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it more in a little bit more detail as we get through the show. Let's bring in our second guest, though. This is the person who, Andy, you introduced me and everyone else to last Saturday, and it's Stephen Pardo. Stephen, welcome into the show. Delighted you're here.
Hey, Kirk. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, it was a pleasure to meet you and to see you go through all the motions of setting up a live sound mix for live sound or for recording, and just watch you and watch you not only do your craft, but to teach and answer questions at the same time. So, hey, we're going to be looking at some video and then talking to you about how you do this after our first quick break here. But Stephen, if you don't mind, just give us a little teaser about what we're going to be talking about today, what we're going to learn here on this show.
Yeah, sure. So just to backtrack one step, Andy, really got to thank you again for having me be a part of it last week. We really had a great time. Myself and the band, we've connected since and, keeping the community building going. So that always feels great. But what we're diving into is last week we took a 4-piece reggae band. We mixed them live to 2-track. All on the board, we had 16 inputs. And then Andy broadcast that as the 2-track live to air. So we'll kind of go over how that process happened, what we were thinking about, and how we get from, A to B.
All right. We're going to have that and a video that was shot at the event, video of the band in the performance room, and also video that we shot in the studio mix room with Stephen leading the activities there. So, hey, first of all, we're going to take our first quick break, and that's to tell you about Nautel. Nautel, a great friend to the broadcast industry and the place where you ought to really think about getting your FM, your HD-FM, your DAB, or your AM transmitter. I spoke with some Nautel folks at the Kansas Broadcast Conference this past Monday. And Nautel does their Transmission Talk Tuesday roundtable discussion. This is something that Nautel does. Sure, it promotes them, but it also really gets information, useful information, out to us as broadcast engineers. Transmission Talk Tuesday, there's one more this month. It's coming up October 31st. Is that right? Yeah, October 31st. Transmitter site considerations, air handling, and cooling. Now, that kind of sounds boring, but you know what? If you do air handling and cooling right, you can eliminate so many problems. If you do it incorrectly, you can cause a lot of problems. And I think this is a wonderful, terrific topic to at least understand the basics, understand what positive pressurization is, understand what a closed system is or an open system, and understand how a solid state transmitter may do very well with a different air handling system than your tube transmitter that you may be replacing. So you'll hear from Jeff Welton, but you'll also hear from expert guests. And if you have a question, you can type it in beforehand, or you can raise your hand during the roundtable discussion, and Jeff can put you on live, and you can ask your question to the group, or tell of your own experience that coincides and dovetails with the topic. So Nautel, we really appreciate what you do for our industry. And of course, Nautel makes fantastic transmitters. I got to look at one of their new VX FM transmitters at the Kansas show this past Monday. And what a little beauty that is. That's an amazing little transmitter. And I've got a VS series transmitter that's 10 years old, and we converted it for HD operation. It's on the air now at my station, my FM plus HD 1, 2, and 3 in Oxford, Mississippi. All right. So that's it for Nautel. Thanks a lot, Nautel. Go to Nautel.com/webinars to register. Nautel.com/webinars. All right. Chris Tarr is here. Andy Gladding is here. And so is Stephen Pardo. So Andy and Stephen, let me throw it to Andy first real quick and then to Stephen. Andy, talk to me about what was your influence? What was your idea to say, you know what? This can not only be an SBE NS workshop, but I can, as you said, I can spice this thing up, because when I saw that at the end, ooh, there's a live mix session at the end of the day. Count me in. I'll be there. What was your influence to do that?
Well, I've attended many Society of Broadcast Engineering events, and I love the formatting. I love the way that the presentations are put together. And I'm always going for the high level stuff. You know, I want to hear about what the latest technology is, the latest concepts, and making sure that I'm up to speed on all the upper level, you know, advanced user architecture. However, I am also aware of the fact that one of the challenges that we have in education, especially when we have a staff that's diverse, we have over 300 staff members at WRHU between students and community volunteers. We have to find things that are appealing to the people that haven't realized yet that they want to do engineering. And one of the ways that I found working at the college is you have to go with what you know, and you have to show the students the doorway in a way that they can connect with. And what do 18, 19, 20-year-olds love more than anything else in media? They love live music. So I saw the SBE as conference as an opportunity to open those doors into the broadcast engineering field by using something that these students could really sink their teeth into, but also have a chance to work on hands-on. And I'm sure, you know, Stephen could agree, and Kirk, you can agree as well. If you looked at that session, and I'm sure we'll see some video and photos of it later, there were a ton of students working on the broadcast, participating, helping the band set up, talking to the musicians, asking questions. That's the way we get them excited and involved. Because what we're doing here is showmanship. So in order to make an exciting show, we have to give them something they want to watch, right?
I'll tell you, before we get over to Stephen, I'll tell you my own impetus for asking Stephen and you, Andy, if you'd be on this show right after your event, was this. I'm a fairly typical broadcast engineer, I think. You know, I've got a real interest in electronics and in audio and in RF transmission, and I'm not perfect at everything, but far from it. I do know the right people to ask. Some broadcast engineers do have mix experience. For example, Chris Tarr on this very show. Chris Tarr mixes stuff at his church. And there are other broadcast engineers that do live shows, do house of worship, things like that. And even some broadcast engineers have recording studio experience. Our good friend Tim Braddock, who's probably watching right now and was at Hofstra the last Saturday. He's got not only – he's a musician. I'm sure he's got recording studio experience as well as broadcast engineering experience. But myself, I've got almost zippity-doo-dah for live mix and recording experience. And I'm really curious to learn about this. So when I saw that, I thought, well, not only will I enjoy this, whatever music's playing, it's live music, it's usually fun. I'm going to enjoy learning some of the techniques. So that's why I was excited about it. And again, before we run over to Stephen, Chris, you agree with what I'm saying? You, sir, have almost weekly mixing experience yourself, don't you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I in no way would consider myself on the level of anybody super professional, but I did learn from some people, and we've got a professional mixing console, Yamaha, and you know, I've learned how to do how to properly mix front of house, which is completely different from mixing for radio. And in fact, we actually have, you know, a second suite that we do for just streaming, which is a lot more, you know, a lot more similar to radio. But, I think that they are two different disciplines, you know, while there is technical things involved with mixing for live performances, it's an entirely different situation in that your ears have to work differently. Like, you know, when I'm sitting in the car tweaking on audio for a radio station, that's an entirely different experience than, you know, sitting in front of a mixing console in an auditorium and listening to the front line or, you know, however, you know, whatever I'm doing at that particular time. So I think there's some crossover there just because of the, you know, the technical aspects. But I believe that probably there are more broadcast engineers that are more on the technical side of working on these things than actually the, you know, the mixing side, because you got to have an ear for it. And, you know, my previous life, I was on the air. And so, you know, I grew up a little bit differently than just fixing this stuff. So I think that's a little bit of the difference. But I do see that hand in hand quite a bit.
So Stephen, my fear is that if I were called upon to do some kind of a mix, a live front of house type of thing or a recording studio mix, I understand the audio technology. I think it would technically, it would be good, but artistically, it might be just awful. So maybe you can start us off, Stephen. Think of us, think of our audience here as look, we can hook mics up. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
We can hook speakers up, you know, and in-ear monitors. Make sure that that all works and there's, you know, a minimum of hum and buzz and things are correct there. What's the next step that a broadcast engineer might want? What would you start teaching people? Where would you start teaching me, Stephen?
Sure. Well, Kirk, let me even take a step back. So where I would start is from the listening perspective, especially as broadcast engineers. Everyone who is listening to this podcast is probably already a pretty good listener. When you're in a mixing environment for multi-track music and you are combining elements in a way that has to allow the spectrum, dynamic, and style, vibe to play through any speaker system and sound reasonably consistent with what the artist is giving you, the very first line of defense is listening, and listening like you would an audience member. So that's where I'd start you off. Now, maybe that doesn't sound like a real insider tip, but it's very easy to get distracted, especially when we're working in real time. There can be a whole lot of things going wrong. You can be in a brand new environment you've never worked in before, have to figure out how to get things from A to B. And really keeping a sentimental mindset for who is your artist and listening to your artist, I think that's where you start.
So again, let's assume that mics are hooked up correctly. We've mic'd instrument amps, we've mic'd some instruments, we got mics. We can learn about mic technique on drums and things like that pretty well. I noticed that when the band was setting up, and I don't have video of this part, but when the band was setting up, a fair amount of time was spent like at the drum kit, and they would just hit the same drum over and over and over again. What was going on at that point? You know, there's a mic right over that drum. What was going on over on your side at the mixing console?
So there's a couple of things going on. Before I even get to the mixing console, first, I'm just making sure that the microphones aren't in the way of the drummer, right? Which can be forgotten very easily. You put a microphone somewhere, and then a guy goes to hit the snare, and guess what? He hits your mic, and you're out of microphone. Sorry, you know. First thing is learning the drummer and the drummer's tendencies and how they actually physically move at the kit. But once you kind of have an idea of that, you kind of know based on style where you want to place your mics. I was telling one of the students that day, we wanted to place the microphones kind of closer to the rims of the drum because we wanted to get more of that tone. Sometimes maybe if you're in a really heavy metal or rock song, you don't want as much of the tone of the rim of the drum. So making conscious decisions for style. But then, as you're saying, coming back into the behind the console experience, you're listening for a couple things. The first thing is just that you're getting signal, right? Just that you're getting clean signal and that your signal is not overly distorted or overly saturated in some kind of way, just that everything is usable. After that, you're getting a feel for if things are in polarity, which is something we talked about day of. You're just getting a feel for general levels. You kind of want to set things in a place where once the band starts playing, you already have a foundation built. So that's where we're starting from.
Okay.
I'd also add that, Kirk, as he mentioned now, you know, like the desk I use is a CL5 and it's got several bangs and you're shifting around. So in order to, you know, to really do that effectively and listen, you can't be, you know, it's hard to be tweaking the entire time and really listening to overall what's going on. So that first, you know, line that you're doing when you first put everything in, you know, as you said, we can get kind of it dialed in close enough where you're really hopefully only needing generally to make minor audio adjustments, you know, once things are moving along. And as for the mics, you know, you got to remember that especially with digital mixers, you only have so many bits. So, you know, if things are too loud, you know, you flipped all the zeros to ones, there's nowhere else to go. It's not nearly as forgiving as it used to be with analog, where, you know, okay, if things are, you know, getting into the clip level, no big deal. You know, it doesn't sound horrible in digital. That's it. You know, you can only flip so many bits and you're done. So it's really important to get all that set before you go.
And those are some really great points. I think just following up off of that, headroom, especially, you know, we're in the digital world. Everyone's pretty much working digital. Headroom is everything. You can take a lot of it. You can always come back to your levels on the two bus and move things as you need to, but giving yourself healthy headroom on a channel by channel stage is fundamentally going to help make mixing easier.
The mics that were in the music room, let's say on the drums or the vocal mics, were the mic preamps built into that audio console in the mixing room, or were they external?
Yeah, Andy can probably speak better to this than I can, but everything was, we had an SI Impact board there at Hofstra, mm-hmm. and every preamp that was used was built in.
Okay, all right. Something that I, you know, how do you mic an electric guitar? Are you micing the speaker, the amp that they've brought with them, or is there more direct connection that you're using?
So I'm going to try not to defer questions, but everything is so situational. I can speak to the situation in the context of our performance recording at WRHU, but it really is going to depend completely on the artist and the content.
Okay, so you're saying you could obviously an acoustic guitar, you're going to put a mic on that, or maybe even more than one mic, right?
Sometimes.
Well, so let's go to your amplifier, because there were some good points that came across my mind. First thing is stage volume or just noise, just in general. You know that the louder something is in the room, the more it's going to affect the other microphones that you're trying to use to capture certain elements. And when we bring up a fader, if I'm bringing up a snare drum, just for the example, if I'm getting 100% snare drum, awesome. You know, I'm just bringing up the fader, I'm just getting snare drum. If I'm getting 40% snare drum and 60% guitar amplifier, now we've got problems. It's going to be really hard to make that feel full in your two bus when you're trying to bring that down into a digital audio file. So what you're going to think about, especially for an electric guitar cab, is, okay, the player, how loud does that player want to hear himself? In our situation last week, that guitar amplifier is the monitor situation for that guitarist. So they have to be able to hear themselves over the drummer who's crashing a cymbal right next to them. So there's also a little bit of give and take between how loud the drums are for setting the levels of your amplifiers in the room, what people need to hear for monitoring.
We are talking to Stephen Pardo and Andy Gladding. Chris Tarr, our co-host, is along, and we're talking about learning how to mix. And after a quick break here, we're going to see video and hear audio from the band that was playing, and we'll see how small the room was. And you can see that, yeah, indeed, they had they had to hear themselves. I'd like to understand if they were using what they were using for in-ear monitors, how that was being handled. And then we'll get to the actual mix, and we'll see Stephen given some instruction to the console and to the students. I'm Kirk Harnack. It's This Week in Radio Tech, and our show is brought to you in part by Broadcast Bionics and Camera One. We'll be right back.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics, designed to bring video to your audio content, visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the ATEM. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16GB of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
And you know, Broadcast Bionics, have been talking about them for years. They're a wonderful sponsor. They make some of the most creative and intelligent software and hardware to help you produce radio pretty much by doing what you're doing now. You just get more content out of the work you're already doing. So check them out at bionics.co.uk or bionic.radio. Thanks a lot, Broadcast Bionics, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tarr is along. I'm Kirk Harnack. Andy Gladding is here. He's the chief engineer for Salem Radio in New York, and he also is at Hofstra University. And Stephen Pardo is here with us as well. Stephen taught a session on live music and music recording at Hofstra during our SBE NS workshop last Saturday. So welcome back, everybody. All right. We have Stephen. Is this a good a time as any to play a little bit of the band video, and so we can see the layout of the room and kind of how things were set up? Would that be all right with you? And I tell you what, I've asked Suncast to if he wants to, if we call for it, he'll drop the level down. We can talk over the music that's being played. So Suncast, go ahead and roll that band video. Oh, I'm sorry. It's the other video, Suncast. It's the one from within the band room. I apologize if I misled you. I think he's got to rack the tape now. I'm sorry. He's got a room full of VTRs up there at his house.
I'm saying as long as it's good out there. Blessing.
Here we go. So it was pretty loud here in the room.
Yeah, and you can hear right now the bass is kind of eating up a little bit of what's going on in the vocals. These spot mics are really important when they come into the board.
Oh, okay. Now, the singer there, he's really eating the microphone. How does he know he needs to do that? And then there's also the keyboardist is...
Yeah, well, we spoke before, and these guys have played many shows before, so they have an idea of what they're doing. So they knew that they were going to have to be right on top of the microphones, for all those bleed reasons.
Now, is there an acoustic reason why that guy left the room with his guitar, or is that just for show?
You're going to have to ask Brian that one.
Okay. And why does the keyboardist have two mics?
So the keyboardist has one microphone going to a mixer where he can plug in vocal effects and basically use one microphone as a live mic feed to me and one microphone as an effect feed.
Okay, that's what I thought, because he would sing in one and I'd hear an effect. The guy in the far back corner, what's he doing back there?
That might be an Andy. I might move that question over to Andy.
This guy all the way in the back?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I think he was the... I'm not sure. Maybe the percussionist. He was away.
He might have been ordering pizza for all I know. I'm not sure.
That person, I forget his name. I'm so sorry about that. But he was so helpful in getting all of the mic lines plugged in and set up before the show so we could just get moving faster.
Okay, so speaking of mic lines, I see a bunch of cables on the floor. How many mics do you think there are involved in this room right now?
There's 15. We ended up having 15 inputs, and that includes a moderator, so it's 14 on the band.
14 for four people. Wow. Now,
yeah.
Wow.
But it's 14 inputs, so not every input was a microphone. Maybe I misled everyone there. But you can see in this shot perfectly that there's a drum pad to the drummer's right side. That's okay. One of our inputs. He also had a timbale. That was another input. So the drums itself was, I think, seven of those inputs.
Okay.
We have two mics on the toms, mic on kick and snare, obviously, and then one overhead. So maybe that's six in total.
Go ahead. Just feel welcome to keep on commenting and tell us what we're looking at here. Of interest.
Yeah, guitar has an amplifier, a pretty large amplifier under that towel. So that's mic'd, you can see. The bass is direct. So we actually have obviously a bass cab in the room, you can hear it. But the back of the cabinet has a direct out, so that's going also into the mixer. And then each keyboard there is going into the keyboardist mixer. So I'm getting both of those keyboards as one line to the board.
I'm not sure where I stopped the recording. Maybe it was right there. Hey, I got to tell you, I enjoyed this music. I had never really listened to reggae much before. The messaging in their songs was so positive. It was happy music. I really appreciated what they were doing. Or did I mishear the lyrics?
Oh, no. You were definitely right, Kirk. One of the reasons why I chose these guys as the test band, if you will, is because, first of all, they're very popular in the area. They're a true Long Island hometown band. They hail out of Long Beach, New York. I respect, but you're absolutely correct. Their lyrics and songs are pretty positive. It's just pro singing, dancing and tapping your feet and celebrating being alive, among other things that I won't really get into on this podcast because it's a little more substantive. But for the most part, that's, I think, a really good way to sum them up.
Cool. Hey, Suncast, why don't we go ahead and roll that other video and just keep the volume down or all the way down, and we will talk over it, and that'll give Steven an opportunity to tell us what he's looking at, what he's hearing, and what he's manipulating, and more importantly, what he's teaching all the students. So we'll look for that. So if you checked all the mics coming in, you kind of got their levels set. Steven, I'm guessing that the next thing you're looking at is the treatment that you give to each mic's audio coming in, whether it's EQ or a certain amount of compression, or if you have some gating available. Talk to me about what do you start doing with, in this new situation with new stuff coming in?
Yeah, so let's assume that polarity is all figured out. The first thing I'm probably doing is just looking at my two bus, seeing where my overall level is and seeing how much headroom I'm giving Andy, who's sending it up to broadcast. But on the individual track level, I think Chris made a really pertinent point, especially in the beginning. It's very difficult to listen to music. We're talking about 14 inputs for this band, to make one EQ change on one input and be like, aha, that's what I needed to do at this moment. What I'm always doing first and foremost is making sure that the vocalists are, or the lead, whoever the lead happens to be, are able to come through, and that the band is able to support them. Really support them means really bringing energy for each individual instrument as well. And then how you start to do that will be with some processing, but I really can't overstate how much listening is happening, and that when a knob moves, a knob is moving because I'm listening to something, not because I want to move a knob.
Ah, okay.
Should I get more technical, or?
Yeah, please do. Yeah, we have a technical audience.
The very first things that are happening right now, what you're seeing is just getting through. Right now, actually, what we're doing is getting through monitor checks. We have, because that's what you saw me just flip to, one of the sends on the board. The band basically had two monitors, live wedges in the room. You saw the singers was up on a stand, and then the keyboardists was, by his feet. That provided its own challenges, but that was how the band came. They didn't have in-ears. We weren't really looking to do a over the ear headphone setup for the video purposes. So it was just, you know, wedges in the room and making sure that those levels are right. And then checking those levels against my two bus levels to see how the bleed then affects the rest of the mix.
Chris, you were piping in with a question or a comment.
Yeah, I got to remember what it was now. We're talking about, you know, everything working around the singer. I mean, that's really, when you're mixing, that's the goal, right? Is the person singing, is the person out front, and everything behind it kind of supports that. And you don't, you know, he's right. We don't really do a lot of EQ changes on the fly or anything else. Really, we hope to, at the point that they start to perform, that really that's all we're doing is minor tweaking to bring that out front. Now, in my case, you know, we do use in-ears. In fact, we have a pretty substantial matrix for feeding in-ears using, you know, with RF and some other Avion stuff, but we can actually, you know, really tweak in-ears. Sometimes that makes a huge difference in how, you know, we have these issues where, you know, in rehearsal, somebody will just kind of sing like this and da, 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 and they get live and they're yelling at it. And you're like, whoa. Which is also why we do the line twice, you know, once during rehearsal and once before actually perform. But it is so important when you're mixing to understand really kind of the texture of the song, because again, if you can't hear the person singing, everything else may sound great, but if it's burying the person singing, you kind of lose the point at that point. So, yeah, you know, it's really important to kind of know not only, you know, who's doing what, but it also is very helpful if you know the material, you know, and can kind of know what it is you're mixing. All of those things kind of combined really helps out.
That's right. Yeah, I completely 100% agree with that. What you just saw me doing there on the board, I just wanted to throw it out, was I'm pretty much, and Chris, I'd be interested to hear if you do this too, I'm high passing most of these channels. The more of that rumble that I can get out of the mix, especially on a track by track basis, the more it's going to build up my two bus just to be clean. And especially because of, like I said, we have 14 microphones, there's bleed. So we're building a lot of odd phase relationships. And especially in the low end, you want to make sure that stuff is tight if you're going to have a good response out of a speaker.
Steve, oh, absolutely. You referred,
go ahead.
And what's interesting is regular engineers will see, you know, some of the EQ curves that we use and think it's ridiculous, but you know, high passing things and again, you really should EQ to bring out, you know, kind of the soul of each instrument and again, as you mentioned, phase relationships, you know, rumbling on low end. You know, even just, you know, as you're setting up microphones, speaking of phase relationships, you know, if you know, we use a drum cage, you know, somebody in a drum cage, and if we don't aim the overheads correctly, they cancel each other out. So there, you know, there's all of those different things, EQ, filtering, you know, and all of that really, you know, there's a lot more, you know, there's a lot more to it than sitting at a radio console, just adjusting faders.
And that's what so many of us are used to. We're adjusting the level and the level only of pre-recorded material that's already, you know, gone through the whole mixing and mastering process. Stephen, you've referred more than once to polarity and making sure that your mic polarity is correct. And Chris referred to it also as phase. What is your audio check? What do you listen for to know that your mics are not miswired? Or if they're placed in such a way that the polarity does need to get reversed, what's your quick check for that?
I'm listening. I mean, you can use a visual check if you want. If your waveform starts negative, amplitude, then it's probably needs to be switched. But not always. That's not always a telltale sign because of the relationships with the other microphones. So it really is, more than anything else, although I don't want to lead anyone down the wrong direction, I'd say low end, but low end in the context of the full signal. The full signal feels more, like it's got a gut. I don't yeah. like it's got.
If it's reversed, it sounds a lot thinner if it's in the wrong phase.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. yeah.
But polarity, like because phase is right our relationships or between polarity, our. Yeah. Right. So I'm just talking about if I just had one microphone on one source and I flip the polarity button, is my speaker, so when my speaker goes in versus when my speaker goes out, is it going to start out or is it going to start in? And based on that, and it's really in the low end that I personally feel this is, but again, checking your whole signal as a signal, that's where I'm feeling the most for what that button is doing.
Okay,
and all I right. think too. After a while, you kind of develop an ear for it. You know, I mean, there are times when I'm not quite sure right away what's wrong, but I know something's not right. And after doing this for a little while, you kind of develop that ear to kind of go, okay, that's definitely the polarity's not right there. I mean, you know, or you know, I'm not sure what that is, but I know that's not right, and I need to investigate that a little further. And that is something, again, that you really only build after you've done this for a little bit, and you get that experience of how everything feels. And that's why sometimes too, I get to a different desk, or a different situation, I'm kind of off for a little bit because it's like, okay, this is a different world from what I'm used to, so I got to change how I hear this, because I, you know, there may be some things I'm not familiar with. But once you get familiar with the gear and the people, or sorry, people, but the gear and the place that you're at, you start to just kind of pick that up. It's like, okay, I know that's not right. I'm not sure why, but I got to figure it out.
We are and talking to Steve. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Stephen. Finish your thought. Kirk. Go ahead.
Pigtail off that. If something's really out of phase, you're going to hear it. It's like the bottom's going to disappear. If something is 90 degrees out of phase and you flip that polarity button, you might not notice the difference and you might say, what's going on? I'm kind of hearing something. Am I hearing something? And there are other tools for that. But
is the effect you hear anything like, you ever been walking through a business where they've got overhead speakers and they sound fine. You're walking and you notice this one speaker you're listening to, and then you walk a little farther, another speaker listening to, and then you walk a little farther and one speaker's out of phase with all the others. And you, there's a weird place I can stand here where it ain't right. Is the effect you're talking about anything like that? Or, and I realize we're mixing these things together. So you punch it in, you punch it out. It's going to sound, it'll either add constructively or add destructively to the rest of the mix, right?
That's right. And that's the key. Yeah. The key really is if it sounds destructive, it is, you know.
Okay. All right. Hey, we got to take our next quick break. We're talking to Andy Gladding and Stephen Pardo, and Chris Tarr is with us as well. I'm Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you in part by Broadcaster General Store, and that's where you want to go to buy lots of broadcast gear, all the things you need, all the little doodads and accessories, but sometimes you need something really, really, really important. And that would be a modulation monitor or a rebroadcast receiver or an RDS encoder, something that is made by Inovonics Broadcast. What an amazing company with a huge line of equipment. Well, at my own stations, one of my problems, we have stations in the Mississippi Delta area. We've got stations in like five different towns. And you know what? You know, as we all know, it's hard to keep employees that aren't overworked and that show up for work. And sometimes we want to just make sure that all our stations are on the air. We want to listen to them remotely. And the Inovonics Aaron 650 has been an amazing box for us at our little stations in the Mississippi Delta area. I don't know if Suncast is ready to show this. Oh, there it is. Yeah. So this is, and Chris, you've probably seen these before. We've got a studio location in Cleveland, Mississippi, where we have an STL tower. And on that tower, we've got this terrific log periodic antenna. It's not a cheap one. And we threw it up there on the tower, pointed it at our farthest away station, and we can pick up with most of our stations, we can pick up great. A couple of them are a little bit weak because they're way off to the side of the antenna. But for the most part, we hear our stations and we can check and see. We can check on the RDS injection, we can check on the RDS operation, you know, the radio text, for example, and the call sign and all that kind of stuff. And we can just check and make sure the station sounds good. we get an indication there about RDS loss, as you can see on the screen if you're watching. Audio loss, RF loss, you can alarm all these things. And then in the case of the pilot's on. And then if you're watching the show here, see in the upper left-hand corner, you can choose a bit rate and hit the little speaker button and stream that audio back to yourself, wherever you're browsed in from. So I've got this browsed in. I've got a password protected and all that. And so you can go into this thing remotely. Hey, from my car, I've certainly listened while I'm driving, or from the house or from the office or even on the road, and just make sure things are working well. Or if somebody does report a problem with one of our stations, I can check it remotely and see if what they're saying is actually what's happening. Some of these, by the way, are our translators, the WNIX-GLH. That is a translator, and it's 40 miles away, but we pick it up okay. Same thing for the WNIX-CLE, Cleveland. It's off to the side, but we can still pick it up okay. It has been great having this thing. Now, by the way, this Aaron 650 is meant as a rebroadcast receiver. The idea of it is that you can receive off the air or via a stream, and then it'll reprocess that for you, and you can put it back out as a stereo generated source for a translator. But we use it as a monitor. Inovonics makes just an amazing array of good stuff that you'll want to use to keep track of your stations, your streams, keep track of your modulation, and they make audio processors too. So if you need something along those lines, check out Inovonics Broadcast. And when you need to buy it from Broadcasters General Store, bgs.cc. And yeah, they got, I know I always say, they got sharp pencils there at BGS. Check them out. The phone number is 352-622-7700. They're not open 24 hours, but they are open at convenient times for you, typically. Thanks a lot, Broadcasters General Store, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. And Andy, I think BGS was at your event at Hofstra, right?
Oh, they sure were. We love BGS, and big shout out to the team over there, especially Dave and Carly. You know, some of us over at Salem, we say we have the Carly fan club, because anytime you shoot those guys an email or gals, they get right back to you with really great pricing, and I'm a huge fan of their products, what they sell, and the way they do business. So we love BGS at Salem.
Wow.
At
WRHU. Folks, I swear that's an impromptu testimonial. I did not ask Andy to say that beforehand, so that's great. Appreciate it very much. All right, our guests are Andy Gladding, who was the host and put things together for the SBE NS workshop and mix session that we had this past Saturday at Hofstra University. Stephen Pardo is our guest. Stephen, I've been wanting to ask you, okay, let's imagine that I was called on to go mix something, and I've never really done this before, although I'm a good engineer. I can get the audio coming in right. What is likely to be my first mistake? What are you going to have to slap my head and say, no, Kirk, don't do it that way. Here's what you'd want to listen for and do. What's a student's first mistake? Biggest mistake?
That's a great question. Let me start that one by referring to one of the students asked me last week when we were working on this workshop, what are you listening for? That was the first question. I thought that was a great question, right? What are you listening for? The first mistake is not listening to the song, that song in that moment, whatever's happening. You need to listen to the song and understand the style, because if you have a band like a reggae band and they have, you know, a tone with a snare drum, that's probably going to be a little like more tone, less thump. You know, it's not a big rock thing. It's a tonal thing. You want to feel that instrument more. If you're not paying attention to that, you're already going to start deviating off their course. You as an engineer need to be connected with the band. I think that's another actual great point, not to go too far away, but communicating with the band is the very first mission. Maybe that's not always as touted in the live sound world as it should be, but if you don't know that band, going up, introducing yourself, meeting them, getting an idea of maybe if they have an expectation for the day or what they were looking to accomplish with their time and their communication with their music, that's going to set you up on the right foot.
Interesting. Chris, as a live mix person yourself, what would you think that a common mistake is that Kirk might make trying this for the first time?
Well, I think what Stephen just said is brilliant. I mean, you really need them to trust you that you're going to handle, you know, your job is to, you know, get their music across properly and in the way that they intended. So, you know, really to get that trust built up between you and them is so important in order to do that. You know, I think some other things, you know, the hardest part is, you know, what are you listening for? What's good? What's bad? And it's kind of like, well, you kind of know when you hear it. You know, there's really no hard and fast rules. But I think the one thing that I really, you know, impress on these guys is if everything is loud, nothing is loud. So, you know, we do have, you know, I've set up different buses for different things overall, and I encourage them to use those as well. So, for example, you know, I've got, outputs that control, you know, all the drums together or, you know, all of the vocals together. And I encourage them to kind of play with that a little bit too, as opposed to just, you know, okay, this isn't loud enough, I need to go higher. And it's still not loud, so I'm going to go higher. And that's, you know, sometimes it's got to be addition by subtraction. And that is something similar that, you know, to what's in the radio world with adjusting compression and things like that. You know, sometimes in order to make something louder, you've got to make everything around it less loud. So, you know, that's where I set up things like DCAs and things for, you know, okay, well, if, you know, you've pretty much given vocals all you've got and it's still not there, let's, you know, let's bring the, you know, the band overall, let's bring that DCA down just a little bit, see if that fixes the problem. So, yeah, I mean, it's really listening and understanding that you need to know the players, you need to know the song. And, you know, you need to know your gear, but just listen and, you know, that feeling, and I'm sure Steven can back this up, that feeling when you get that mix right, you just know, it's just like you smile and you go, oh man, that's perfect. You know, that's when you know you got it.
Yeah. You're just listening. Yeah. I know I'm not trying to just repeat what you're saying, but it really is so pertinent. If you are acting on an EQ because you're trying to figure out what the EQ does, you are not EQing correctly. You can be practicing, but practicing and playing have a gray line between them, and you really want to play. You want to get at that board, and you want to be able to push the entire experience in a forward direction. You don't want to fiddle. So keeping engaged, always listening, and I had one more point, but I lost it.
I think sometimes people
fiddle too much too. Sometimes, yeah. You know, you have all of these controls and you feel the need to kind of keep tweaking them. And sometimes it's just as much of a chore to just know to just keep your hands off them. But you know, when I do training for our guys, you know, I want them to do that. I want them to take each control and push it to the limit so they can hear what exactly it does, so that in the future, you know, it helps them understand what they're tweaking.
That's right. Yeah. And I remember the last thing, mixing into compression. I highly recommend mixing into compression. If that's
really,
enough to say.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
What does that mean?
Well, Kirk, I think you asked me this during our session last week, which is there a place for a limiter in all of this? The answer is, of course. I mean, I'm personally trying not to touch my limiter. My peaks are staying healthily below my limiter, and then if there should be a process of getting my two bus to where it is, then I'll start pushing into the limiter on the two bus. But my point is, before the two bus, I'm never hitting my limiter personally. But mixing into compression, just having compression, even a 1.5:2:1 ratio, and just as you're moving into your two bus, knowing where your threshold is and knowing where it starts to push up against you can really be a great way of keeping your levels consistent and knowing where you need to get your vocal, so that way you can start to frame the band around that.
All right, I got a novice question here. Several times you've said your two bus. That is, I've never heard that expression before. What are you talking about?
So in multi-track, you have to get as many channels as you have down to a left and right stereo.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm stem. Sorry. I call that the stereo bus. You call it
I'm just calling it the two bus. It's where I'm putting my stereo processing.
Okay. Okay. Now, all right. So is the processing in a separate bus or is this on your main left-right bus?
In we need to move fast scenario on my main left-right bus. We can get into the whole studio side with rear bus and parallel compression, but not going to go there right now.
Right. Right. Understood. Understood. Okay. Okay. I got so many questions and we don't have enough time. I'm not going to name the band, but there's a band that I like that was very popular in the late '90s through the early 2000s. And they had one big hit cause it was in a movie, and they had a few songs that were, you could tell they were produced by a producer and maybe mix engineers who were really professional. The songs just sound great. And the rest of their songs, I love the songs, but they are so horribly mixed that you can not very well. The trumpets are always fighting with the lead vocals or the violins or the keyboards. And they're fighting. And you can't enjoy the song because you can barely hear the lead vocal from underneath all the other stuff that's there. And they even have one song that they have like the badly mixed version. And then they had the one that was a hit. Same song. And obviously the one that was a hit is so much better. There's room for the lead vocal to be there. You can hear each and every instrument. So sometimes I wonder, is that a matter of arrangement or is that a matter of recording and mixing or mastering? Stephen, if that kind of problem, who's responsible for the mess that I hear when it's not the good version?
I think we could send that question to either Andy or Chris as well. So my overall take on this, and then I'll transfer over is just there's a reason why we're using more than one microphone, and if we were only using one microphone, we would be positioning everyone around that microphone in a way that is as simpatico as possible. Mm-hmm. I think that a quote unquote bad mix is very much what Chris was saying before. Everything needs to be loud, and then you get lost in translation.
Andy?
You know, the two things I encountered very early in my multi-track mixing sort of self-training was playing on the what Steven talks about, everything needs to be loud. You get excited when certain parts come out that you really want to feature, but then you forget to turn it back down, or you're not really thinking about how that part works with the rest of the mix. Like, especially with more complex mixes that have a string section, a horn section, maybe multiple keyboards or guitar parts that are acting as padding parts, the temptation is there to begin pushing things up. And then as the part that you initially like gets buried, then you go and push that up again. So before you know it, you've got a brick wall of noise that at the end of when you're doing your final mix down, you're saying, how did that get here? It was perfect. Subconsciously, you're kind of letting your ear and your brain's desire for that ear candy get in the way. The other thing, and this is very, very common, I know we have it at the educational level, and I think even with people that are in the professional side of the business, is over-processing. There's a temptation to over-process everything because what the listener, a lot of the times, I think the listeners are used to hearing very processed, condensed audio at the end of the chain, whether it's an MP3, whether it's something coming through a codec. People are used to listening to compressed audio. So when you're in the mix room with all the high-end monitoring gear and the beautiful amplifiers and everything that's sort of untouched, you don't have that over-processed sound there. And it's almost like an innate desire to get it to that point before it's even out the door. So yeah. I think it's probably been in this situation where the vocalist will say, well, the vocal doesn't sound right. Well, yeah, it doesn't sound right because it sounds perfect. It'll sound like what you want it to sound like after it goes through a bunch of gain reduction and codecs and Spotify's algorithm, it gets smashed to crap and then put into your little iPhone. Yeah, it'll sound like what you want it to sound like. But in this room, let's keep it pristine. And then we'll screw it up once it goes into the transport phase.
Hey, we are talking to Andy Gladding and Stephen Pardo. Chris Tarr is along with us as well. He's got mix experience, and he's got experience with Angry Audio, one of our sponsors. Chris, it is your turn, buddy, to tell us something about Angry Audio that maybe we didn't already know.
Well, you know what? As a matter of fact, the Chameleon Audio Processor is something that a lot of live venues are starting to look into for that two bus processing. Basically, it's a really light hand audio processor. It's a gain controller, multi-band, so it doesn't have any kind of pumping or breathing, and it's got Cornelius Gold's special sauce in it. In other words, it does a very good job of maintaining your levels without sounding like it. So you can, and it uses the left scale, so it is compatible with a lot of the gear that's out there today, and you have a for the live stream, for on-air processing, for studios, that's where the studio audio processor comes in. And you can go from a real light touch to a real heavy touch. And with the C6S, you can get that as like a VST plugin if you're using, you know, Pro Tools or Reaper or something like that. You can get the software version of that, and you can use that as an insert for your final mix. And what it is, it's just basically a nice light hand on the volume control. And, you know, nowadays, you know, the equipment we used to use, the gear that we used to use for some of this stuff is no longer made. You know, or at least some of the stuff is, if it's not made or if it is made, it's really, really super expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, so like the LA4A, I'm talking to you, you know, whereas the Chameleon is, you know, sub-$1,000 device, plugs right in. It's got analog and digital. It's studio hub, so it's really easy to connect. And again, there's really nothing to mess around with on it. It's a very simple set it and forget it kind of device. If you don't need the processing, it doesn't do anything. It freezes. And we're talking about that with the cleanliness of audio and how things nowadays get squashed. And yeah, I'll talk to production directors all the time that keep trying to use all of these, you know, different plugins and things to flatten their audio and make it really loud. And I try to explain to them, hey, you know, we have $12,000, $15,000 audio processors that do that, and they only work if the audio going into them is clean. That's why they sound like that. So, you know, you need to be able to have, you know, something to work with. And that's what this will do. If the stuff you're producing doesn't require a lot of dynamic changes, it won't do anything. It'll just freeze and just pass the audio as it is. If things start to get into the danger zone, it steps in and makes a little minor adjustment to that level. So it's a great device if you want to look at that sort of thing. I guess I know of Shane Tovin uses one at his church for their mixing and loves it. And I use it for some streams. I've used it for some other things. And it works really, really nice. It's just kind of that, you know, stay out of the way unless we need you kind of box. So check it out online, angryaudio.com. You can get it from your favorite broadcast distributor. They sound great on the air. They sound great on streams. They sound great in live environments. Just a really nice, easygoing audio leveler. The Chameleon from angryaudio.com. Check them out today.
Thank you very kindly, Chris. And hey, we're going to hear from Max Connect in a sec, but I once again, Kirk has failed as his job as host to warn our guest, Stephen Pardo, and Andy Gladding, too, if he wants to. We finish up the show with a tip of the week. And so maybe Stephen can ruffle through the wastebaskets and find us a tip of the week to close the show out on, having to do with his profession and teaching folks about what he does. All right. We're brought to you in part by Max Connect, including Max Connect Wireless, which is the product that kind of put them on the map. They do so much more now. But here's Gary Morrill to tell you about it.
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
And, you know, I had the opportunity to use Max Connect at a transmitter site. We were waiting for 6 weeks for our fiber to get installed at the transmitter site. in Oxford, Mississippi, where we have our HD, our FM, HD1, HD2, HD3, and Max Connect did a superb job of giving us internet when we desperately needed it, and it was just terrific. So thanks a lot, Max Connect. You'll find them on the web at Max. I know it's spelled funny, M-A-X-X-K-O-N-N-E-C-T, maxconnect.com. And they offer other services too. Thanks a lot, Josh Bone, for sponsoring our show. Okay, we wish we had another hour or two, because we certainly could talk about it. Andy Gladding is along, and he's the one who put this together and it got us introduced to Stephen Pardo. Stephen, a spotlight's going to be on you, man. Pressure's on. I need a tip of the week. What can we have engineers walk away with, maybe wanting to know more or learn more, or something that you have found to be particularly helpful in your job?
So I'm just going to, right off the bat, steal what Andy just said. Don't overprocess. And what I'm talking about is really, if you find yourself in a live mixing situation and you are not sure what to do, don't. Just listen. Take it one step at a time, enjoy the music, do a processing decision if you hear the need for the processing decision. If you are not live and you are in your bedroom and just messing around and you need to learn what an EQ does, turn that thing all the way to 10 and turn it all the way back to negative 10. But when you're live, do more listening than processing.
Andy. Maybe you have a tip as well. I know I didn't really alert you too well, but your students were certainly enthralled with what they were seeing. Is this a great way to teach students, bring them into an environment that they just naturally going to love and let them see how the magic is how the sausage is made?
Well, you're absolutely right, Kirk. And the thing about that is that when you have a group of students in a centralized location, like a college radio station, oftentimes, they don't know what it is they want to do or what it is they might be interested in. So by creating a palette of opportunities, you are exposing them to things that they would have never even thought about. This is what what they always tell me after we do any sort of broadcast engineering related events. They go, "Oh, I never even thought about that." Or, "Oh, I've always wanted to do content." And I say, well, content everybody does for free. I mean, doing the engineering, you can actually get paid. In terms of my thoughts going along with this, is my tip of the week is don't be afraid to think about things that are wild, crazy, and large scale productions, even using the environment you have at your disposal or the tools you have in your toolbox. Perfect case in point, earlier this week, last week, WMCA put on a huge gospel concert and live broadcast in Times Square, which ran simultaneously. Four-person talk show with guests on one table and a 6,000-watt sound system broadcasting straight or projecting straight down Broadway from a location about 20 feet away. And we had the ability to tie both environments together. Why this is important? Because whoever thinks about putting a live concert on AM, people would say, well, that's silly. It wouldn't work. We had about 5,000 people come to see Hezekiah Walker and were clapping and singing, hands in the air. I mean, I'm not even much of a gospel music guy, but I made sure that before the production, I went and listened to a ton of Kirk Franklin, and I got that mix dialed in pretty good going over the air. So you have the tools, and they're sitting on a shelf somewhere. Don't be afraid to dust them off and say, hey, I got a great idea. Let's do it. Doesn't matter what it is. Let's do it big. Because when you do it big, people want to be involved.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Chris, do you have a tip you'd like to leave us with this week, or do you think we have enough to think about?
No, first of all, Kirk Franklin's awesome. I would have loved to have been there. That would have been awesome. He's fantastic. What I would add is, even if you're not planning on doing any kind of live mixing at all, if you're a broadcast engineer, find some place where you can just kind of shadow somebody, because I guarantee you, not like tonight, I'm going to be mixing at a rehearsal, but I guarantee you it will help you in your job in general. Just first of all, the tech is really interesting, but second of all, it just to kind of understand from that point of view, because a lot of times by the time you get the audio, it's already been through this process. But for you to understand what that process is, I think will only help you later on, to have that in your toolbox. Well, I know what they were thinking when they were doing this. And, again, as an engineer, we want to be respectful of the audio and respectful of the artists. And I think this gives you some insight that you wouldn't normally have.
Awesome. And I'll leave a tiny tip. Years ago, I was listening to two processors. Frank Foti was a little annoyed with me for not being able to tell the difference. And then he said, listen to the individual instruments. Don't listen to the whole sound field. That's important too. But right now, Kirk, listen to the individual instruments and compare it, you know, these two different feeds and see what you think. And sure enough, that's where I heard the difference. So we got to listen broadly, and we got to also listen individually to see how things are going. I'm sorry, did somebody else have a quick comment before we go? Okay, sorry, I thought I heard a noise. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Chris Tarr, our co-host here just about every week. Andy Gladding, thank you for being with us, chief engineer at Salem in New York. And Stephen Pardo, thank you for being with us as well. We're going to have your links to your information in the show notes, and I'll send you updates on that. Suncast, thank you so much for being at the helm, at the controls, and keeping the show going. We got to run. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.